Okay. All right. Well, welcome to today's topic, which I've decided to call, and I've said this to no one, but I thought breaking Hallyu. No? Okay.
Breaking?
But that's what I can break. It was sort of like a Breaking Bad, but breaking Hallyu because, oh, there's so many ways to go. Actually, I was thinking about it like a breaking wave because Hallyu is the Korean wave. And, you know, it's that when the wave is breaking, it's that moment when surfers kind of get excited. It's, you know, it's what they're waiting for. It's the rush. It's the energy, the ride, you know, and that's kind of what the Korean wave or Hallyu kind of feels like. It's been building for years. And every time it breaks, it brings something new, whether it's, you know, music or drama or fashion or film, you know. So today, that's what we're going to do. We're going to dive into that wave with two great guests here that we have, Dr. David Tizard and Courtney McLaren. And we're going to explore what's behind Hallyu and where it's headed next. What's the next wave? But before we get into the conversation, please let me introduce them properly. And ladies first, Courtney McLaren is a researcher, educator, and avid Shinee fan with a master's in communications from Simon Fraser University in Canada. Woo-hoo. Her work encompasses transcultural fan practices and Korean popular culture with a focus on K-pop fandom. Her master's research explored K-pop fandom across Canada with a goal to more recent fandom voices in the continually asked why K-pop question. Outside of her research interests, Courtney is currently a native English teacher in Goyang, South Korea, and spends much of her free time reading, crocheting, and annoying her friends with about Shinee. She's also a proud animal lover. I think she's taking care of the animals that that are disadvantaged here in Korea as she goes about. She's got a soft spot for cats, appears. We'll get into that. Our second guest is Dr. David Tizard, who is a professor at Seoul Women's University and Hanyang University. He's a regular contributor to television and radio. He holds a PhD in Korean studies, writes a weekly column in the Korea Times, and hosts the Korea Deconstructed podcast, which we should put a link there in the chat. David hails from Dover, Kent, and has lived and worked in Seoul for more than two decades. So he's a lifer here. And last week, September 16th, I believe it was, celebrated his 44th year with a morning run, 10 kilometers, I believe it was. And so in amongst everything else already does, he still has time to get out there and pound the pavement. So Dr. David Tizard is a prolific reader, a polyjamorous music lover and musician, and he's an all-around inspiring sort of guy. I did see him speak at the last national conference we held in Yongin, and I really enjoyed his talk. And what stuck with me was how he presented what he was talking about. And so I'm looking forward to some more of that sort of energy. So that's a bit about the backgrounds of our guests. So let's jump right in. Dr. Tizard, Courtney, thank you for both for joining us today. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I guess my first question, and I'll direct this to you, David. What is Hallyu?
It's a very broad question. Well, thank you. It's thank you for the introduction. Thank you for telling everybody how old I am. Courtney, it's wonderful to be on this event with you for the first time. Go Shinee. What is Hallyu? You've already said it, by the way, Greg. Hallyu is the Korean wave. It was a term that was coined not by Korean people, I guess if we want to tie this all in, K-pop Demon Hunters is about Korea and it's boosting Korea's popularity around the world, but it's not really made by Korean people. It exists in this kind of third space. It's being made by people, the same people that made Minions and the Lego Ninjago movie. You know, it's made by outside executives, people with an interest and sometimes a family connection to Korea. But Hallyu is the same way. It was a term that was coined by journalists in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, in China. I'll get in trouble by calling them all three distinct places. And when they saw Korean culture coming into their countries at the end of the 90s, the beginning of the 2000s. And so it's a Chinese term. Here in South Korea, people didn't call K-pop K-pop until around sort of 2007. Again, K-pop is an outside term, just like you know, people would call it C-pop and J-pop and K-pop. Here in Korea, they just called it Ingigayo or Daejeongumak, sort of pop music. Why would they call their own music K-pop? So the idea of Hallyu and K-pop being heavily associated with Korea is really interesting because Koreans have only taken on sort of ownership of these ideas and these concepts, after they've been created, at least the terms, by other people. Technically, because it's the Korean wave, it means cultural products or things that originate in Korea and then go overseas. So sometimes in my work, I've drawn a distinction between what you might call a Korean drama and a K-drama, and Korean pop and K-pop, because the ones that are labeled with a K are kind of technically designed for export, and they're designed to go overseas, and they're made with an international audience in mind. And then other things are made purely for domestic consumption, and they're made for the people that live here. And those ones that I've classified as Korean contents. Of course, you know, the lines between them all are very blurry, but Hallyu is something that starts in Korea, and it goes overseas. It's really interesting to me when once one of my Chinese friends said to me, David, have you watched, for example, you mentioned it, Breaking Bad? And I would say, you know, no, what is it? And they would say, oh, it's an A drama. And I would tilt my head. It's like, and that's an A grade drama, an A list drama. No, it's an American drama. Sort of in China and other parts of this region, they have ways of classifying things. We don't think of it sort of as an A drama because we other everything else, and we think R1 is the main one, and everything else needs a denomination to label it. But not always. There's some ideas. I'm sure Courtney will have lots to say about that.
I'm
Yes.
curious. I have a question. Is shiny Korea pop or K-pop then?
I think that's
That's
for
an
Courtney.
interesting question. That's a very interesting question. I would say that they're K-pop in the sense that they are a part of the whole like K-pop system that was designed in part to be exported. The whole like how to phrase the building of K-pop in China, break into the American, break into the global industry. They're part of K-pop, but in the sense of them personally, like their goals as a group, because they've been around for, it's been 17 years now, they enjoy and are consistently grateful and surprised that they're very globally loved. Taemin and Anyu just did world tours, Key's starting a world tour, and they were shocked at the fact that they sold out in multiple different countries. But at the same time, for them, they're not really focused on promoting globally. They're not trying to be the next BTS. They're not trying to be the next Monsta X. They just want to put out music. So for them, I think they would say that they're a Korean pop band. But if we're talking about the label of K-pop versus Korean pop, they're a K-pop group.
Great question, Andre. Well, so on the K-pop, and you're from a you are have a distinctly Canadian perspective. What does sort of how does K-pop or how you translate in Canada?
So I say the word in Canada because when I was doing my research, I had to put fences around my project. I wanted to go much bigger, but resources, time, and money were major factors in the fact that I only focused in Canada. And the perspective I come from is transcultural as opposed to transnational. So transnational focuses on the nation. It's like, why do Canadians like K-pop in Canada? Whereas I'm asking, why do fans in Canada like K-pop? They might call themselves Canadian. They might call themselves Korean Canadian, Asian Canadian, French Canadian, because I do have a lot of Quebecois fans. K-pop is huge in Montreal. I'm not looking at why X nationality is a fan of X nationality is a fan of Y culture. I'm looking at why people are fans of Y culture. And my responses, what I found from all of these fans, is that for some of them, it was an identity thing. A lot of Asian Canadians were looking for something that they could identify with that gave them a sense of belonging, a sense of community. A lot of fans talked about, particularly in terms of BTS and Monsta X and some other groups, the concept of struggle, the concept of overcoming adversity. And the most common answer that I got, the whole underlying basis of what my research discovered, is that it makes people happy. That so many fans, I would ask them, why are you a fan? And they're like, they could talk for 15, 20, 35 minutes. And at the end of this huge long talk, they would just say, you know, it just makes me happy. They just make me happy.
So I want to sound, I agree, I totally get that it makes them happy, and I'm actually glad to hear that. I'm just wondering how, excuse me, how. If I guess we're saying that the K-pop Demon Hunters is part of K-pop, right? It's export. But fair to say? No?
I
I
wouldn't
don't.
say, yeah, if David wants to take it too.
Because you started off, David, saying that it was really not a Korean made thing. It was made by the same people that made Minions, etc. And so I thought, okay, so this is a K-pop thing. No?
No, it's not made in Korea and designed to export. It's made outside of Korea, and it's using Korea as the backdrop for telling a wonderful story. It's the same as when you look at something like Kim's Convenience, the drama, which was set in Canada or set in America. I'm sorry.
Toronto, Canada.
Do forgive me.
It's okay.
That's, that does a wonderful representation of parts of Korea, but it's certainly not, made in Korea and designed for export. Minari, the movie, Pachinko, the drama series. I'm sure there's others that I'm forgetting, but these are not part of the Hallyu thing. They add to it, and they help bring people across. And a lot of people might not really draw a distinction between them. But I would say personally, K-pop Demon Hunters is. It brings people towards Hallyu and Korean content, but it's not Korean made and designed for export. It's actually quite the opposite. And that just shows you the popularity of Korea that, now a little bit like something like Turning Red, or Kim's Convenience, that Korea is now used as a backdrop for something cool, not something based on war and depression and division and violence, because you can make something, about that and the struggles, and we have MASH in the 70s, something like that. But what Korea is now, it's cool enough that outside people, and I don't use that term with any disrespect, executives in other parts of the world with money and influence want to use Korea as a vehicle to tell different stories, positive stories, empowering stories. And they're going to do so because it's going to be incredibly popular. They're not doing it just for like vibes and representation. As much as that works, they're doing it because of capitalism, and because it will sell, and because it's hot, and that's why. So for me, Courtney might have a different opinion, but for me, it's not part of Hallyu.
I have a question. Oh, sorry, Courtney, you first.
want to add on to that, because I would also agree that it's not necessarily, one could argue, and I would actually probably bet that many Korean scholars outside of Korea are saying that this is Korean because there's discourse around there. I would not say that it's necessarily Hallyu. It's definitely not made in Korea for export. However, I've been reading a lot about what Maggie Kong was saying with her whole, and also the music too, the musical director. A lot of what they wanted out of the story was an authentic depiction of Korea, which living in Seoul, I think that they've very, very wonderfully done that. And it's a very interesting discussion because if we're talking at the macro level of capitalist interest, this is not a Korean-made production. It is very much not. But in terms of the directors and the heart and the people who did the actual creating process, I would say that they would maybe argue differently in the sense that it's not Korean, but it is part of Korea. Because the director is Korean Canadian. A lot of the, all the singers are Korean. Most of the production team, the artists, a lot of the artists are Korean. I've been seeing a lot of the artists, the background artists on Twitter talking about their process of drawing everything. So it's a very interesting, nuanced discussion of to what extent is it culturally Korean or culturally Korean, Canadian, Korean American, Korean dash whatever. And then monetarily, economically, control-wise, how to what extent is it actually a Korea product? Which I would not say very much so at all.
And I will add something onto this, Courtney. I think that's very well expressed, and it's perhaps a little bit more sensitive and nuanced than I was making it, because the depictions of Korea in Demon Hunters are amazing. It feels authentic. It doesn't feel like an outside view. And I think that's one of the reasons why it was so popular. But also, that's a lot of the way that Hallyu is going at the moment. You have a group like Cat's Eye in K-pop, and it's about where does that authentic Koreanness lie, and can you do Korean content outside of Korea? Because if you take something like jazz or rock or techno or disco or a Western or a cop chaser movie, you can do those in any country. Rock music is not restricted by ethnicity or nationality. You can have French rock. Probably you guys have Canadian rock. I'm teasing you. I'm teasing you. Go Bryan Adams. No. But they're not limited by nationality or ethnicity. Now, Korean content generally has, and that's why I've argued that sometimes K-pop is not a genre, because you can walk into a studio and you can make any genre of music, but I can't make K-pop. Why? Well, look at my face. And that makes it different from another genre, because you're not understanding it musically, you're understanding it in terms of nationality, ethnicity, culture, identity, something like that. What we've seen in the last, at least the last couple of years, and you have things like XG, you have things like Cat's Eye, you have groups, the one that came out of England as well, Dear Alice, I think they were called. I might have got that wrong, but they're challenging what it means to be part of Hallyu, what it means to be part of Korea. And so, for everything that I did say, that conversation is very fluid, and it's changing at the moment.
I would actually like to see David try make something K-pop.
I have. No, I have. You
Oh!
can listen to it online, of course.
Oh, cool. We should put a link into that when we release this video. Okay, my question has changed slightly, and it's for both Courtney and David. How much of K-pop Demon Hunters could be considered a Korean story? I mean, we've established that it was made from the outside looking in by and previous insider, right? So, but how much of the story do you think actually relates to Korea?
Well, I read your article, and that's where my answer was going to come from, David, is I did read your article. The nuance of self-sacrifice and the I definitely don't I haven't spent enough time in Korea to really understand the nuances of all this. I'm not going to take that answer from David because I think that he could say it better than me. For my perspective as a K-pop fan who goes to concerts in Korea, they captured the experience of being a fan so wonderfully in, and it's very easy these days to very quickly cross the line into making fun of fans. And fans have always been like something to punch down on. Like you have the Trekkies and Star Wars fans and the the quintessential gamer living in their mom's basement, the screaming fangirl. Like, fan has already always been a pejorative term. And the way that they depicted the K-pop fandom culture was wonderfully accurate, and in such a fluid way too. The way that at the beginning they had the fans explaining who each of the members of Huntrix were was so amazing. And then the experience of a fan at a concert, and even one of my favorite moments, my favorite song is Your Idol. And during that scene of Your Idol, the fans are slowly losing their souls, and it's supposed to be like a dangerous moment, but at the same time, the way that they captured the fans of like how the fans are looking at the Saja boys is exactly how a fan would feel. And they managed to do that in a way that was really respectful, which I found fascinating. And I was very appreciative of it too. So I would say that in terms of K-pop culture representation, they did that very, very well.
And I agree with that, and it's wonderful to hear those descriptions from you, Courtney. And they did it in a very nuanced way, didn't they? They showed how meaningful fandom was for the fans of Huntrix and the idols in there, and the Saja Boys as well. They showed how meaningful it was. They showed the experience, the community. They also showed some of the darker elements of it. They showed old Ajummas with the broccoli haircut in visor. They showed boys, they showed girls, and so I think it was almost they showed the light sticks. They showed what it felt like to stand inside a stadium and to feel that sense of community, where it's almost like a church, a religious experience in a way. So I thought that was excellent. It was almost a love letter to fans, and it gave people who are not necessarily fans of K-pop that experience. It gave them this sort of vicarious satisfaction, this Derry Manjok, this way. And this is what it feels like to be swept up in Beatlemania, a baseball game, WWF SmackDown, whatever it might be, but in the K-pop way. And so I also thought that was excellent. Beyond that, we've talked about this outside inside watching it. The convenience stores, the oriental medicine, the rolls of gimbap, the streets of Seoul, the Namsan Tower, the Lamyon, everything about it, it looked and felt and almost smelt like the country that I inhabit and have lived in for the last 20 years. So it got it so right. And there's a lot of discussions these days, you know, about cultural sensitivity and representation. It's almost like a minefield in terms of popular culture, of what's acceptable and what's not, what's cultural appropriation and what's cultural appreciation. These are conversations that do resonate in parts of the internet and parts of the world, and for good reason sometimes, and for reasons I don't understand other times. But K-pop Demon Hunters got its representation just on a basic level so well. And then Courtney touched on this idea of self-sacrifice, how when I started watching Korean movies, I'm thinking now of something like JSA or Sopyeonde, going back 20 years ago or something. I was amazed because I'd get to the end of the movie and the good guy died. And I would be sat there and my sort of mouth would be open and I wouldn't quite be comprehending what was going on. And all the Korean people around me were like, yay, that's right. And I grew up with James Bond, you know, and he kills the bad guy, he gets the girl in a kind of, you know, James Bond way, and they go off into the sunset and good defeats evil. And that was what I was used to. And I started watching these Korean movies, and I would get to the end of the movie and I would realize, oh, wow, things work a little bit differently here. You know, you get to the end of Park Chan-wook or Bong Joon-ho or any other movies, and you realize that the ending is not what you've expected. And I got to the end of K-pop Demon Hunters, and you know, the boy and the girl don't get together. The boy sacrifices himself because he's, you know, he's committed this Confucian sin of betraying his family almost. And how do you redeem yourself that? Well, through suicide or through taking your own life. And that demonstrates not psychological weakness or mental health problems. It demonstrates a sense of innocence, a sense of duty and obligation. Now, that's a very dark topic, and I'm not saying we should be careful with that, but that's a common trope that I've seen in lots of Korean dramas and movies where the good person, the virtuous person, will sacrifice themselves for the community. And in doing so, they demonstrate some of that. When the lead of Huntrix, when she goes to meet, so it's been about a month, all the names have gone. When she goes to meet
Rumi.
Rumi, when she goes to meet the woman who raised her, and they're standing under a tree, and she's talking about the patterns on her body. I can visualize the moment very well. And it got kind of dark, and I was watching it for the first time with my daughter, and I was worried about how dark it was going to get. Eventually, it didn't get that dark. It remains a children's movie that you can watch with young people. But I remember thinking, oh, where are they going to go with this? Because I was so in tuned or used to seeing what Korean content will do. So sacrifice, the usual cultural representation. I thought it was wonderful. I called it in the article, I think, a love letter to Korean culture, and I think it's very much that.
Just a
Has it
quick.
been, has it been, has it, sorry, has it been received though? The reason I asked that is because, as I was talking before we started, that some of the people that I've talked to, and these are people in their 20s, so say between 20 and 30, who haven't watched Demon Hunters, have no intention to, and really they've heard of the title, but that's about it. The only ones that are kind of fans would be the kids. And you say it is a kids' movie. But it does, it's entertaining to adults as well. Like Frozen was a kids movie, but it did speak to adults as well, and they all kind of got sick of that song. But so in this one here, I just wonder, is it actually speaking to Korean people? And if other than just the kids who are watching it as maybe just simply as entertainment. Even if it only speaks to kids, that's not a bad thing. Harry Potter speaks to children. Star Wars speaks to children. The fandom of children shouldn't be seen as anything less or anything as less rewarding than if it speaks to old people that like opera. But it really does speak to children. I watched it through the eyes of my young 8-year-old daughter Elizabeth, and seeing that representation, Courtney spoke in her research that she was doing how identity is such an important thing for many people when they get into K-pop. I'll never forget one of my Vietnamese American friends, and they told me they wanted to get in touch with their Vietnamese roots and know their father better. And they started, trying to listen to Vietnamese rap and pop music, and they were just like, I don't like it, I don't get it. And instead, they found Korean pop because it was a little bit more accessible, it was a little bit more Western. And through that, they got in touch with their Vietnamese American roots. The same with this in terms of do people get it or not? It's about being seen, it's about being represented. And, I was so happy that my daughter can see herself on screen. She'll go to K-pop dance classes on Monday and Wednesday, and then be watching, Youngji and Eugene and Mimi on the telly and dancing to IVE. And then she can watch a movie about this young girl going through things that looks like her, that lives in the same country as her, that's using the same language. She's not watching, and this is said with no disrespect, she's not watching a white, blue-eyed, blonde-haired girl that's not her. And so that's really important. I think that was huge. And it doesn't just apply to Korean children, but to all sorts of children around the world that want a different set of representation. Also, in terms of popularity, Greg, what I've found really interesting is that I could ask my sister-in-law that's just out there drinking her own coffee, clutching it like this, tell me about BTS. And she would struggle to name a couple of BTS songs, to be honest. She's in her mid-40s, but she loves them. And she respects them. Why? Because they make Korea seen, because they give Korea a voice, because now Korea is not a forgotten country. People don't just talk about China, Japan, and then they finish. When people go abroad, and now when people say Korea, people don't say North Korea or South Korea. And they weren't saying that like in a low-key racist way. It's because people quite seriously didn't know much about Korea until sort of Psy and Gangnam Style really exploded that. And so what this is doing, whether people in Korea watch it or not, and people have watched it and enjoyed it, it's making Korea seen, it's representing Korea. And I think that's such an important thing.
That's really cool. And I have some questions for you guys on your opinion on some of the elements in the movie, like the Hunmun, right? The music protecting society from the demons. I found that really interesting because, in a sense, based on what David has said, the K-pop kind of protects Korea in a sense from some of the more traditional elements, which David, the scene that you mentioned, of Rumi talking to her aunt under the tree, that's actually the scene that really got me because traditionally you would expect the aunt to say, yes, be yourself, right? But the aunt did exactly the opposite. She said, no, hide, don't show everybody who you are. Put on the face because it really matters what you appear to be. And then the message in the movie is actually a very Western message in the sense of individualism and be honest about who you are, but it didn't come across in the Western way. Put in the against the Korean background, it was actually really meaningful. So these kinds of elements, like the Hunmun and those kinds of aspects of the movie, that's kind of a comment on Korean society. I found that fascinating. Really,
Let me add
really.
one thing, and I'll promise I'll let Courtney speak. But just about that, the way you phrased it, and I thought you were going to call North Korea the demons at one point. I was going to get really worried when you did that. But in that scene, you said her aunt was doing the traditional Korean view, Confucian, hide yourself, do the right thing, and then Rumi went with the Western view. Let's perhaps try and see if we can reframe that as saying that was the traditional Korean view, that was first, second generation K-pop, that was this idea of perfection. And rather than being a Western view of individualism, that was the new Korean view. That was the way that Korean people have changed. That's what people want from their K-pop stars a little bit more these days in the fourth or fifth generation. They want to see the vlogs, they want them writing songs. And so rather than being sort of this East and West dichotomy, we could also frame it as old Korea and new Korea, or even sort of, second generation K-pop versus fourth, fifth generation K-pop. But Courtney, Homuns, and all those things.
The first thing that I thought of while you were asking the question, Andre, was that for the Hanmoon to even work, it needs the fans' voices. And that was shown at the very end when all the fans started singing with Huntrix, which is a huge part of K-pop fandom culture, is during the encore part, the idols will go off stage for a little bit. And during this part, while they're usually changing into the merch that's for sale, they all put on the t-shirts that everyone can go buy. During that part, fans will choose a song and sing it. So you'll have 15,000, 30,000, 55,000 fans who have pre-coordinated to all sing the same song. And it's such a communal experience. And sometimes I think the most recent concert I went to, we didn't even wait. Normally at Korean concerts, you don't sing with the idols. It's not necessarily, it depends on the fandom, obviously, and the group, but usually you just listen, you cheer, you do the fan chants, you scream. The most recent concert we went to, the whole stadium was singing the whole time. And it's such a communal aspect of it that even though the message could be interpreted as like individualism, not hiding yourself, be who you are. The experience of Rumi showing who she was also a communal experience because it brought her friends back to her. It's you can't do it alone. It's not an individualism thing. It's more of a you don't have to struggle alone. And I lost track of the second thing I was going to say because that was really important for me to get across that like it's music. And I was also reading an article this morning that a lot of the storyline was centered around the kind of music that they could make. K-pop was really the grounding narrative that they wanted to make sure that the story tied in with the music very, very well. And the Andrew Choi, the singer of Jinu, and I believe it was Audrey Nuna, one of the Huntrix singers, both talked about how the story of and the music that they sang and the whole overarching idea of K-pop Demon Hunters being something where music brings people together It's been a talking point since BTS blew up in 2017, how it doesn't matter what language the music is in, it creates community. Like, that's, I think, a more grounded way of interpreting the whole, like, first gen, second gen, third gen individualism versus collectivism. That's the thought I was going to say. I have seen a recent interview. I'm not sure if it was Keith from SHINee or if it was a different second gen idol talking to a newer idol, an idol from a newer group, about how these newer idols get away with stuff that the older idols would have never thought of doing at their point in their careers. Like, idols can call their fans out now. Idols are starting to legally go after fans for abuse. Idols can be a lot more free in how they say things and what they do, and they don't have to necessarily project a, I don't want to say perfection, because they still are held to a certain perfection standard, but they're not given a script to follow. They're not told, here is who you are. You now must force yourself to fit into the box we have given you. And I think that that is a really good thing about where K-pop is going. There's so many things wrong with the industry, but the push for a little more freedom that idols have been given now is, I think, a really good way of interpreting that when we bring it back to K-pop Demon Hunters.
I'd like to, it's amazing, Courtney. I'd like to add something and perhaps go back to Andre's question about this Hanmun. You know, when I first heard the word, the way I interpreted it, I think it's incorrect, but the soul in Korea is Yonghon, and Moon is gate. So I was, you know, is it linked to sort of these two characters of soul and gate? Traditionally in South Korea, shamans would keep evil spirits at bay, and they would communicate with evil spirits. And how would they do that? Through song and dance. Before we had this sort of rational approach to the world, what people would do is they would communicate with spirits. They would keep the balance between the forces of nature and all of these different types of things. I nearly said good and evil, but it's not good and evil, because here in East Asia and certainly in Korea, there's no personification of the devil. That blew my mind when I realized that Satan, Beelzebub, Mephistopheles, the devil, that doesn't exist in this culture, in this folklore, for thousands and thousands of years. You know, they'll have doggebies, goblins, and things that go bump in the night, and but they don't have this kind of good versus evil dichotomy. They would have things different, and to control and keep balance, keep harmony, that was done by shamans, by mudangs, and they would be performing guts. And how would they do that? They would do that through song and through dance. It didn't look like a K-pop performance as we know it today, but it was a ritualized performance. It was sort of acting and projecting an image. And so I think music and dance traditionally in Korea has always been a way to communicate ideas, and also to keep spirits in check, and to keep the grace of the king and the mandate of heaven and all of those things. So there is a traditional element to it that the people were, I think, intentionally going on to. They were trying to link it, weren't they? The hunt tricks through the, you know, this is just the latest version, and in the future we'll get something like Plaive. We'll get the AI idols that do it next. So I think there is a deep connection to it culturally and spiritually, perhaps.
Yeah. Another aspect of the movie that I found fascinating is from the beginning, the demons feed on people's negativity and guilt, right? So at the end of the movie, part of the story is moving away from negativity and guilt. That's also what's parts of Rumi's conversation with her aunt. So I found that fascinating because I recently saw an article which claims that that's the new era. It's a guiltless era where you're not, guilt is not the thing that drives people anymore. And I found it fascinating that that's written into the movie as well. That's really cool.
You're not meant to hide your. You've heard so many stories about people living overseas that would hide their Koreanness, that would have to hide their gimbap and their kimchi because it wasn't cool. They would have to hide who they were, and not just sort of Korean families, but Chinese and Vietnamese and Japanese or wherever they might be, because it was about assimilating to a dominant culture. You. Now I see some international students that will proudly tell me about sort of their neurodivergence or things like this. And so there is this shift in the culture. I agree with you. We're not trying to put our best self forward, at least some people. We're trying to put our authentic self forward. And that seems to be one of the messages. Be yourself, express yourself. You know, how good this is, we can get more deeper into it, but is there a real self? Is it not just masks all the way down? We play a role when we go to the office, we play a role at home, we play a role when we meet our friends. The idea of this single, unchanging, authentic person, again, is tied into the idea of the Western Judeo-Christian soul, right? That we have this thing that never changes, never moves. We're Atticus Finch, and this is who we always are. I'm not sure about that, but I think it really helped me with my daughter, Andre, when you say about sort of Rumi accepting the patterns and accepting the things and not hiding them. And that's the big breakthrough, the climax of the movie, and that's what helps good defeat evil in this, that she will not hide. She's going to show herself to the world. She's going to show scars and all. And it's okay to be a little bit broken. It's okay to be a little bit sad. It's okay to not be okay. Seem to be one of the messages. And I, you know, watching it with my daughter and letting her know that, because if I tell her, it's one thing. If some cool K-pop stars tell her, whether they're animated or not, and she loves them and she loves the music, that's another thing. So I was happy that my daughter had that message. Sometimes it's okay not to be okay.
Yeah. So, or very, very
I
deep
think
you. Oh, sorry, Courtney, you go. Yeah.
that guilt might necessarily not be the right word. I think that shame might be a better way to frame it because shame is such a huge part of Korean culture, and it's also a huge part of just being a human person. If you're ashamed of something, that you can feel the weight of that. It's so heavy. And Rumi plays it so well, the way that they designed her, the way that just the whole character, the shame that she has of having these patterns, of having them grow, of her fear of her friends finding out, that the message of you don't have to be ashamed of these things. Even if you're struggling, we'll do it together, I think just is so well told in K-pop Demon Hunters, and the way that it can resonate with kids and with people. Just quickly going back to the whole, like, does it resonate with Korean young adults? I can't comment on Korean young adults. I can comment on young adults and adults maybe under 35 who are not Korean. We thought it was just going to be a comedy. We thought it was going to be making fun of K-pop. Like, none of my friends wanted to watch it. My one friend who did watch it immediately started bullying me to watch it because she said it was so good. And I was like, there's no way it can be good. There's no way. K-pop Demon Hunters, it's going to be a mockery of everything that is K-pop and Korean, and just there's no point in watching it. And I think that it's a story that people really, really want to hear. They may not know that they need to hear it, but the appeal of it, even if it doesn't seem like it appeals to adults, unless you're a parent or like someone who watches it by accident, or if you're a kid, the appeal is just for everyone. It can appeal to everyone. And I think that that's a strength of the movie.
There's definitely a strong Jungian acceptance of the shadow in Rumi. Rumi is a perfect personification of the Jungian acceptance of your dark side. So I thought that was really cool. So in the movie, I was kind of sorry for the demons. They didn't have a very good deal, I think. Yeah.
Just looking at the time a little bit, Andre, and I'm just wondering whether any viewers had put any questions in, so if there are, that we could address those.
Not yet, but this is a good time to remind people who are watching that please put in questions if you have any questions for David or Courtney. Then we can relay it to them. And you're right, the time is moving, but I have one more question for everybody. 'Cause I don't know if you guys know, but at Everland, they're going to set up a K-pop Demon Hunters area where they're gonna sell the merchandise, sell the food. But one of the really interesting things they're going to do with the help of Naver, because Naver has the technology to do it, they're going to set up basically a virtual performance of the K-pop Demon Hunters. And the technology that Naver has basically has a stage, and then behind the stage you have real people dancing, and then with those suits on that copies the movement. And then the characters, the avatars, will be there in 3D dancing and interacting with the audience. So I find this fascinating because it seems to me that K-pop Demon Hunters is going to be where the major shift is from, I like Courtney said, idolizing real people to idolizing AI avatars, because you already have that. You already have avatar groups that are famous. But it was interesting to me to watch the K-pop Demon Hunter situation, because Sony Pictures made it. Netflix has all the rights, but the music rights actually belong to another company called Black Label, which used to be YG Entertainment, right? And I don't find that there's a lot of focus on the actual singers behind the K-pop, behind the Hendrix. These companies don't seem to promote the actual singers. They're focusing 100% on the virtual singers, on the Hendrix. And I find that fascinating, because that's weird to me. Usually the people who were the voices would be the focus, and they would be the ones invited to sit to have a concert, because everybody wants to see the real people sing. But it seems like people don't want to see the real people sing. They want to see the avatars. I find that fascinating. What
I
do you think
think
about
that
that?
it's good observation. I think that's the way K-pop works. By the way, something like Plave at the moment, they're a virtual K-pop band. They're huge. They do vlogs, and they're all animated. There's nobody real, and there's people behind them, obviously, but they do vlogs of their training sessions and dance routines, and they perform concerts to, 10,000 people. And they're a completely animated group. You could go back to something like Gorillaz or that kind of thing. Yeah, exactly. But in K-pop, Andre, you would get, and Teddy Park was a big reason why the music of K-pop Demon Hunters works. And Teddy Park is from one time in YG, and he did so much of the music for Big Bang and Blackpink. You can hear him all over that. But the way K-pop works, if you take somebody like Kenzie from SM. Kenzie from SM, she wrote for SHINee. She wrote a lot of songs for SHINee, and she's written songs for SM for basically 20 years. And she could walk down the street and sit in a coffee shop, and you would not know what she looks like. And if you write music, you get all the money, right? And so she's written from everybody from SHINee all the way up now to Esper and these kind of things. And K-pop has generally always been about somebody behind the scenes write the music, a Teddy Park, a Kenzie, someone like this, even a JYP, and then the performers perform it. And that's the way it works. And it's the same way with people like Elvis or things like this. But so I don't really see anything new. Instead of changing the group every couple of years, we'll put some different ethnicity members in there, and then we'll put some virtual members in there. It just seems to be a natural evolution of the way K-pop has always been to me.
It's very interesting. Courtney?
Also, the character appeal, if we're talking about, because K-pop Demon Hunters, like, I've seen adults with the little derpy keychains. I want one. I want one so bad. But there's no official merchandise that I can find yet. They're all terribly made knockoffs. But I went to the drone show that they did for K-pop Demon Hunters a couple weekends ago, and when I say that it was just kids, like it was packed full of kids. And it was fun to hear all these little kids just singing songs that are in Korean and English. It was really fun. But if we're talking about a concert, even though the appeal is very broad, I don't think that they would get the same pull if they had Andrew Choi on stage the same way they would if they had Jinu on stage. And I could see Naver, who has their hands in a lot of different pies, using this technology as a way to be like, hey, SM, hey, HYBE, look what we can do for you if you don't already have your own tech, which SM obviously does. But also, reading an interview with Andrew Choi, who has also worked with SHINee. I love Kenzie. I love, if you're a fan and you know the music enough, you know the producers. Like, I know about Kenzie. I know a lot of the choreographers. I follow a lot of them on social media. But Andrew Troy was saying that he's been in the SM basement for decades. It's just where he lives. But as much as he enjoys making his own music, and as much as he is looking forward to putting out new music, he actually said that he much prefers being behind the scenes. Like, he would rather not suddenly be doing all these tours. He's very happy with the success, and he's very excited to see where it will go. But him personally, he would very much rather stay behind the scenes and just like sing a couple times and then go back to his office and keep producing in the studio. So, yeah, I think that there's a lot of layers to that. It is an interesting question on like how come you don't hear about the actual voices behind it. And I think that that's a lot of musicals, like a lot of musical films, especially ones for kids. You don't hear about it because that's not where the attention is, and that's not where the money's going to go.
My
Unless
kid.
you're the writer, if you're writing the music, you're going to get the money. So I'm very happy for all the writers.
My kids have no interest in meeting Daniel Radcliffe, but they would love to see Harry Potter walk into their room. And I think that's a similar thing. Audrey Nuno, I just say this, Audrey Nuno, she was on SPNS channel. They have a great thing. It's with Omega Sapien from Balming Tiger. And they did an episode in English with Audrey Nuno. And she talked a little bit about the experience. She said during that during the recording of Golden, during the vocal recording of Golden, there was a ghost in the room. Oh. No, I'm just relaying what she said. She said there was a Gusin, and it's like, oh yeah, okay. So, whether she's telling a story or not, but that's the story she told last week on a podcast. Wow.
Interesting.
Oh.
Sorry,
It's good
Courtney.
channel.
I want to listen to that episode now. I'm going to have to go find it.
Yeah, I'll send it to you. It's good.
Oh, I have two comments, one comment and one question from the viewers. So weird to say that. Lisa said she's very thankful for you guys spending the time doing this. And specifically to Courtney, she's looking forward to seeing you. And then Philip Garcia asked if Netflix and Sony will do a theatrical release of the sequels, because fans have been demanding it. Okay, I'm completely out of that loop. So, what do you guys think?
I know that at the Busan International Film Festival, they're screening it as a sing-along, so that's exciting. As for like international theaters here, we need announcement of a sequel before we can even decide if a sequel is going to be theatrically released. Considering that the States and to an extent, Canada is part of the market. Like, it's quickly accessible for the States and Canada as it being a Netflix Sony production. If they made it cheaper to go see, I'm sure people will go see it. But by the time that a sequel comes out, there's no guarantee that people will want to spend the money on it. Like, it's very hard to say. If they released sing-alongs now, and I'm sure they are. I don't know about Korea, but I think that there's been a couple theaters that have released sing-along theatrical releases. People would go do that now, and I'm sure people are doing it now.
What is that
But
exactly? A sing-along release?
so you go to the theater, and everyone has agreed, the social contract is that when the songs are happening, you can sing. You can join in, as opposed to going to the theater and everyone just sitting quietly and having a good time, and then three people suddenly break out into song. Yeah. There might be the lyrics on the bottom of the screen. Oh, my friend just messaged me and said there are lyrics at the bottom of the screen. So there we go. They have the sing along there.
Yeah, the Netflix sing along has that. They have that, all the lyrics. There's a
Oh.
Netflix. There's a the Netflix has the movie and the sing along movie, which is the same movie just with the subtitles.
That's interesting. How do they do the Korean lyrics
I
in each? I wonder how they do that, the romanization for them.
good question. I don't know.
I'm gonna have to. I don't have Netflix. I had a friend lend it to me, so gonna have to check that out.
Have to watch that. Have you seen the sing along, David?
I haven't seen a sing along, I haven't been to one, but I know, people go and see the Rocky Horror Picture Show and they dress up and they go and sing along while they do it. I haven't been to one myself, but I'm aware of the culture. And in Korean, it's daechang. Koreans are famous for it, that idea of singing along. Many artists from around the world have come to Korea and gone, God damn it, you guys sing here like loud, to the extent that there are articles about it in the culture that people will be paying, however many hundreds of thousands to go and see, God forbid, Coldplay, but then they can't hear the music because the person next to them is singing so loud. So there is this well-documented culture of collective singing, and Koreans pride themselves on it almost to the extent that they want to be the loudest sing-along location on a global artist tour. They want this global artist to talk about it. They want to be louder than Japan and China. It's part of national pride for them. We sing the loudest, so yeah.
It's funny because in Canada we are so quiet, we're so reserved, and I think we kind of get needled for being exactly the opposite. I don't know if we're proud of
Feel
that
like
or not.
I don't have that experience. My only Canadian concerts were K-pop concerts, and we were not quiet.
It's a generational thing, perhaps.
Maybe.
I grew up watching Trailer Park Boys, so I would love to see Bubbles in concert.
Okay. Well, it's been an hour, so if you guys want to wrap it up, that's fine. If anybody else has any more questions or comments, now's the time.
I'll just say that this has been a real treat for me. I have not, I'm so on the periphery of this talk, but am excited to go deeper into it. I just really appreciate the minds that are here today and sharing your insights.
I would say one thing about that, Greg, is that, I have to study Hallyu. And so I've started watching Bon Appetit, Your Majesty, the latest K drama, because I teach courses on Hallyu to not only Korean students, but international students. And I can't walk in there and not know anything about it or not having seen these things, because these are young adults and very passionate and sometimes very, very knowledgeable. And sometimes I'll watch things and I'll listen to things and I'll be like, yeah, maybe it's just me, but I don't really get it, or I don't think there's. And then sometimes I will come across dramas and music and movie that I'm like, that slaps, that's great. And for me, K-pop Demon Hunters was one of them. And I've shown it in class to my students and, discuss it together at the university level. And I'll do the same again this semester once we get round to that period of time. But I think for all that might be said about it, it's a great story that's well told with love, and it came out just at the right time. And just like Courtney said, there was so much hesitation about it, a quick capitalist cash grab. It's not going to be cool, and it's almost going to be, offensive to those that truly love the culture. But what it did is it gave people a chance to see K-pop and fandom in particular in a positive light. And it was a love letter to K-pop. And so we need a little bit more like that, because The Glory and Squid Game and Parasite, it's very easy to get these kind of dystopian images of Korea. And as soon as I go like write a column about, Korea's pretty cool, or I like Korea, you see the comments going, Korea, everybody's depressed and single and killing themselves and gender. And the idea that Korea can be nice is an important message, I think, and it sometimes get lost. So well done to K-pop Demon Hunters and for all those that took part in it in front of and behind the scenes for doing it.
Adding on to that, and also I just saw Philip's question, so I can kind of expand on that a bit. But especially with K-pop reporting in the States, or I should say in English, because the UK is at fault at this too, every article has to have a dark side of K-pop section. There has to be something wrong with this industry. There is something wrong with the industry. It's very, very, very toxic. It's harmful. It's abusive. To be an idol, to answer Philip's question, the training period can go from 2 to 3 to 10 years, and they keep starting younger and younger. Like Taemin from Shinee, I think he was 12 when he was either 12 when he signed or 12 when he debuted. The oldest was 18 when Shinee debuted. And the rigorous training, they have singing, they have their dance classes, they have for SM, they have like how to act on stage, how to hold the microphone, how to answer a question. And then if you do debut, you're in debt. All the money that you make the first few years, you're paying that back to the company for the training period. And then if you do become big, there are negative aspects of fan culture. And capitalism plays into this, the whole like pitting people against each other, the new rise in streaming culture. Streaming culture has always existed in K-pop fandom, but the fact that Billboard is now part of it, it's like you're not a K-pop band unless you make it onto Billboard, which is a whole other discussion. But just the pressure to be perfect, the pressure to always perform. I don't like saying cult just because there are so many negative connotations to it, but you could say cult. There are people who wrap their entire identity around this to the point where it's unhealthy for both them and then the parasocial relationship they have with the idol. And a lot of idols, it's just healthier for them to quit. It's healthier that for them to move on to make music on their own, where they have more control, more creative freedom, less pressure to constantly be on, constantly be perfect. A good example is the new trend of like the TikTok dances. Every dance has to have a specific hook for a dance that everyone can do. And then during the music show filming, the weekly awards shows, there's one awards show building that has a specific staircase that all the idols film their dance TikToks in front of. And it came out a couple months ago, I think at the beginning of the year, it came out. There's actually a little ticket booth, and the idols have to take a ticket and wait in line. And their managers are just standing there, like, okay, your turn, your turn, your turn. It's not a choice. They're not given a choice to do these TikTok dances. It's very much like, this is now a part of your routine. And your routine might be a 20-hour day. So there's so much wrong with the industry. But at the same time, there's so much good. Music brings people together. And just because there's problems with the industry, just because there's problems with Korea, with Korean culture, with the way that Korean culture can impact people, doesn't necessarily mean that that's the only thing about it. It's just like how there's not one facet of a person, there's not one facet of a music genre or an industry, I should say, and there's not one facet of a culture.
Awesome.
Well, if we've done nothing other than inspire some healthy conversation, I think this has been a very good thing to do. This, what do we call this?
Webinar? It's
Webinar. Okay.
new to me
Yeah.
too. Okay, but yeah, thank you very much, guys. Oh, and Lisa just wanted me to remind you there's a workshop in J&J Kotetsu November 1st. Just so you know.
Slid that in there. Thank
Yes. Okay, but
you
thank you
very
very
much.
much. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you,
Thank
guys. It
you.
was awesome and very informative for me too. Thank you very much.
Enjoy your day.
Okay, until next time.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.